Attachment parenting has been receiving media attention again thanks to a Time magazine cover that showed a mother breastfeeding her 3-year-old son with the headline, "Are You Mom Enough?" The reaction to attachment parenting seems to be against the practices rather than in favor of them. But are attachment parenting practices the best way to raise your kids? Find out what we think this week on Family Anatomy.
Hosts of Family Anatomy are psychologists, but they're not your psychologist.
So if you need to talk to someone about family or mental health issues, you could get a referral from your family doctor. This show is for information only.
Welcome to Family Anatomy, your source for parenting and relationship information with your hosts, Dr. Giuseppe Spizzano
and Dr. Brian McDonald. You can find us at familyanatomy.com or over on iTunes, and let's get right into it. We are talking about attachment parenting today.
Wow, this is going to confuse people.
Because we've been talking about attachment again and again and again, and about parenting.
We talk
about parenting almost every
week.
It's
like that show again?
Yeah. Are they
really
going to talk about that again? Well, no.
It seems like, well, what we're going to talk about is really rather different from what we've ever talked about in a way. I mean, we might have touched on this before.
Right.
But it's not the attachment parenting that we usually think of when we talk about attachment parenting.
No, and it's, well, first of all, most of the time when you talk about attachment parenting, you're talking about infants, although the practices do go beyond infancy and into the toddler years and even beyond those. But it's all about the bond with your child, right?
It's
just like attachment theory is.
Exactly. It's just that attachment parenting, that phrase has kind of been taken over by people who are focused in the very earliest years, like, you know, up until toddlerhood usually, right?
Usually, yeah. But if you look at Attachment Parenting International, they talk about bringing the practices into the later, even the preteen and tween and whatever those other stages are that they call them now.
Yeah.
Tween is kind of a new one.
But the reason we're doing this show is because there's this article in Time magazine that's, I guess, become really...
It's been all over the news,
yes.
This stuff, right? Because the cover of Time magazine had a woman breastfeeding her 3-year-old.
Right. So they're not talking about teens and
no. That.
They're talking about very early infancy to toddlerhood.
Exactly right. Exactly right. And it caused enough of a fuss. I mean, the kid's 3 years old, but the cover caused enough of a fuss.
Looks like he's 8.
Yeah, it's true. They did pick the kid who looked the biggest.
Tall 3-year-old.
I don't know how.
That's the photography doing that?
It seemed to be like they shot it from below to make him look even bigger.
Yes.
But yeah, it's getting such a reaction. You saw it on The View. It was on, they talked about it on Weekend Update on Saturday Night Live not long ago.
It was on ABC News, The View, yeah, Saturday Night Live. It's all over the place.
It's been all over the place. And most of what they're talking about is extended breastfeeding more than anything else, but attachment parenting isn't just about breastfeeding.
That's right. And I feel like it's mostly, well, there's 3 or 4 main things that are typically talked about in attachment parenting, and they are.
What? Oh,
the
put
quiz.
Me on the spot. Well, it was Bill Sears, right? Back in his baby book.
Dr. William Sears,
whose son is on a show called The Doctors.
Yes,
and
I saw that.
I didn't see whether he has any reaction to this cover or anything like that, but...
I did read about it, and I think his reaction is that people can extrapolate from what he says.
Yeah.
To a lot of things that his father doesn't believe.
Yes, exactly.
Now, Dr. Sears extrapolates from his own stuff, which can get a little out of control as well.
Right, right. But what he advocated in his baby book, the main things I think that they talked about in Time magazine and that they're talking about a little bit on TV is breastfeeding being very important.
Right.
Co-sleeping.
Check.
Baby wearing?
Baby wearing, yes.
So keeping your baby in a sling?
And the fourth is a little bit more, it's not as central, I guess. It's whether you let the baby cry or not.
It's whether you let the baby cry or not. And Dr. Sears believed never let the baby cry.
Right.
Don't let them cry for a second because
and that's
those,
one of the things though, that was like a little bit exaggerated.
Right. Those stress hormones
never.
Will damage
I mean,
the kid's brains.
You know, as much as you can, you don't let them cry.
That's right. That's right. Yeah, because, I mean, he admits that sometimes, right? I think even he says dad should send the moms on a spa day and spend some time with the kids themselves.
Yes.
Right? Although his idea is primarily it's the mom who's going to be caring for the child because breastfeeding has to happen on demand.
Pretty much.
Right?
Yes, and the child self-weans, I guess, is the idea.
That's right. And, you know, this cover came out and a week or two, or I can't remember exactly when it was, but have you seen this Alicia Silverstone video that's been floating around the internet?
No.
With her feeding, I guess her baby's a little bit older. I don't know how old. His name is Bear. I don't know how old he is.
Yeah.
That's
his actual name.
So that's his actual name. And she feeds him food from her mouth. Like
oh,
a bird.
Yes, of course. I've heard that. Yes.
Right. So that's one of those things
she
that
chews it up.
Yeah, she chews it up. It's
regurgitates
pre-chewed.
It.
That's one of those extrapolated things. I don't think that's something that Dr. Sears talked about.
I don't think. No, he didn't. And not everybody necessarily has been reading his book, although I guess it's, it's sold, or I think 1.5 million copies around.
Right. But there's like, tons of websites that talk about attachment parenting, and there's other books that take Dr.
Right.
Sears' work.
And I think it's just the kind of the culture around it. Let's go back to talking about the magazine just for a second, first of all.
Oh, history.
Why is it? No, I was going to do that, but we're
going
to go.
I knew you were going to.
Before we skip over the magazine altogether here, let's go back to the central reason why this became such a big deal and why we decided to talk about it today. Why was this thing so controversial in your view?
I mean, you've got this attractive woman and an older child, and they're breastfeeding on the cover of a magazine.
Right.
Right? And so you get a view of the side of her breast and you've got a kid who's older than infant, than an infant. So I think that's where
like
the reaction
four
came
or five.
From. He does look older than three.
Five. I mean, I have a five-year-old. He looks a little taller than my five-year-old.
Well, no, he's standing
looks like
on a chair.
A big kid. And not only that, but this is a 26-year-old woman from California.
Yep.
And I'm assuming, and I would almost say I'm sure, that that's not how she breastfeeds.
With him standing
you know
on
I mean?
A chair,
come
probably
on over and
not.
Get on the chair. No,
no.
And that, first of all, that's not the idea. If you think about co-sleeping and the baby sling and the breastfeeding, it's all about having the child close to your body.
Well, and I
and you're
think
attached to the
yes,
child that way.
Yeah.
It's not like at a like this little distance between you because he's on a chair and he's got his arms to himself and she's posing. She's got like one
right.
of her. She doesn't have her arms around him. He doesn't have his arms around her.
And I
it's
think
not,
I read
that's
an,
not what it is, and I'm sure that's not what she does.
Well, and I think I read an interview with her. I've been reading so much about this magazine, and there were so many things on the Time website even that sort of link to the article that's in the magazine itself. It seems to me I read an interview with her where she said she was a little bit surprised that that was the picture they chose for the cover because they took a lot of pictures. That one seemed to be the one that would generate the biggest reaction from people, which, of course, is what you want on your magazine cover.
Which is what happened. And, yeah, I'm guessing you're in a photo shoot and, you know, doing the same pose over and over again doesn't work. So you have to get creative and they get to choose which one they're going to put in there. But it's not an attachment parenting
That's not the way an attachment parent
at all.
Would necessarily do
so
it.
So they're
no.
not really promoting it that way. They're trying to get a reaction. And the reaction they're getting is to something that seems more sexualized. Like they're sexualizing attachment is what I feel is happening there.
Mm-hmm.
And it's making it kind of deviant in a way.
Yeah.
And it's actually setting back the cause of attachment parenting.
Well, I mean, like I said at the beginning, most of the reaction that you see in the news has been not positive reaction to that picture. It's been negative. And then you get the occasional interview with someone like Mayim Bialik, who's also follows the attachment parenting practices. And so there's, you know, there's some kind of effort at balancing it out, but it's not, It's not really balanced.
No.
It's not really balanced.
And then there's a judgmental aspect to it as well, right? That because the headline is, are you mom enough?
Yeah.
Right?
Mm-hmm.
And so I guess if you're not, you know, looking fantastic and, you know, able to breastfeed your child, even when he's older, that means you're not a good mom, or you're not mom enough, or there's this judgmental quality to it, I guess, that really, I think, like moms, I think I've mentioned this to you before, the level of guilt that can be induced in women, I think, mm-hmm. about being moms is much greater, I think, than in dads.
I would say so, yeah, absolutely. And the fact is, I mean, if you look, and I look through the World Health Organization, who of course advocates breastfeeding, and I found a few articles there and elsewhere, and I found a survey from 2005. I mean, okay, it's 7 years ago now, but not that long ago, really, in the grand scheme of things. In 2005, only 43% of people in the U.S. believed that public breastfeeding was okay.
Right.
So less than half of people think it's okay to do it in public. Here's a magazine cover. And on top of that, there are some other articles that I read that looked at even the moms who believe in breastfeeding and would like to breastfeed their kids for as long as their kids need it or want to be breastfed, will say that there's a stigma around breastfeeding kids who can walk, who can talk, and who can take it, who can sort of unbutton your shirt and or lift up your shirt and get the milk that they need.
Yeah, I remember that one of the jokes I heard was, you know, if your son comes home and he drops a briefcase, probably it's time to stop the breastfeeding.
Well, then there was a recurring character on a TV show called Little Britain who was an adult, this upper class adult guy who would be going places with his mom, and he was still being breastfed, and that was a huge joke.
Right. And I mean, and there's another thing about it too, I guess, you know, and this is part of what's making it more sexualized. And there was one woman I talked to recently that was saying it's kind of icky is the word she used.
Really?
And she had a hard time like defining what icky was, but I think that's what she was getting at. But why is it a boy on the cover with his mom and not a little girl on the cover with her mom, right?
Well, they want a reaction.
Again, there's this kind of sexualized thing.
We're feeding into it by even talking about it now on this show.
We are.
Jeez.
So, but here's
they got us.
They got us. Here's the other interesting thing that I found about this, that, you know, one of the things that, you know, it's like there's no way for women to win on this one, right?
There's no doubt about that.
You know what I mean? So if they don't breastfeed, it's because they're selfish, right?
Right.
That's the idea. But if they breastfeed too long, it's because they're selfish, because they're getting their needs met somehow. Like they're getting their own attachment needs met. Like they're dependent on their child. Yeah. The child wants to get
off. Or it's
off.
A political statement. Or
the,
it's...
You know, wants to be away and be a bit more independent. But the mom's keeping them there with the breastfeeding because of her own needs. So it's selfish that way. So mm-hmm. you can't really... It seems like you can't win in terms of being judged, you know?
There's going to be judgment either way. And you can see that in all of the surveys and even moms are feeling it because they get questioned about it, right? The papers that I was reading was moms were being asked, are you going to breastfeed and how long are you going to breastfeed? The baby's not even born yet, right? Strangers are coming up to them saying, how long are you going to breastfeed your kid? They're like, well, okay, he's 3 months old. Leave me alone.
Well, you know, it did generate a lot of discussion, which is good in a way.
Yeah.
In a way, it's good. It's just that it seems to be discussion based on extremes.
Yes.
At least that's what the media picks up.
Well, and if you look at the View, that opinion that the cover is icky, well, that's basically, I mean, they spent 10 minutes talking about the fact that it was...
How icky
it was. It's just icky. That, it's just summarizing the View's discussion of it, that is icky.
Yes.
As far as, that's what I got out of it anyway.
Which is besides the point, I think. That's the whole thing. Like, it's doing a disservice to real attachment parenting.
Well, and the question is...
And you know, beyond that, like I said at the beginning, as far as I'm concerned, when I think of attachment parenting, I don't just think of the first earliest years. Of course not. First, the infancy to like 3 years of age.
Absolutely.
And we've been
not.
Talking on the show about attachment all the time, and people probably assume that what we mean is attachment parenting. We almost never talk about the first 3 years. We've talked about it a few times, but mainly we're talking about your kids who are mm-hmm. 5, 7, 10, 18, whatever it is.
Exactly. And often we're talking about our own kids who
are, you know. Not even that. We're talking about attachment with couples.
Yeah.
So it does go through the lifespan.
Right. And honestly, I mean, research on attachment is very different from attachment parenting. And in fact, most of the things that attachment parenting advocates that parents do, there's not necessarily a research basis behind it.
That's right. But you know, the interesting thing though is that it does come from the same sort of
history.
There we go. But see how smooth I did that? You didn't have to call attention to it.
You were waiting for me to call it.
That was a beautiful segue. There was nothing wrong with that.
Yeah, that's okay.
I could see your eyes shifting. There's something going to happen.
Our listeners are getting
You can see that Dr. Sears,
yes,
right, comes from a tradition that starts with John Bowlby, Dr. John Bowlby.
Well, I mean, even before Bowlby, he was reading books about tribal parenting practices and the connection and the bonding right?
Right. And well,
it was Bowlby who operationalized and defined it as attachment.
Right. But I think what happens there, because I don't read anything in the research I did on Dr. Sears that he mentions Bowlby. Right? I'm saying it's part of that tradition.
Yes.
He reads a book that came out in 1975.
Right.
By actually this woman that was living in New York. I think she was a part-time model. But she was also liked to travel. And so she went to South America and she was, interested in indigenous culture.
Right, yeah.
And she found that the women there
uh-huh.
had the babies real close to them,
yep.
didn't let them cry. Well, she didn't see them crying. They seemed all...
They didn't cry. They were happy.
Secure and happy. And
there was no
fine.
Need for discipline because the kids were well-behaved.
And she was so impressed by this that she wrote a book.
Right.
And Dr. Sears read that book. So yeah, right. It goes beyond in terms of experience, obviously. It goes beyond 1952 or whatever it was when Dr. Bowlby wrote his book.
And it was also a reaction to Dr. Spock's idea that babies should just cry, like break them of their need for the parent.
Their dependency, their dependency. Yeah.
And Martha Sears, who wrote the baby book with Dr. Bill Sears, said, this doesn't make sense. This is not the right book for us.
That's right. But you see, you go even further back in the 1920s, you get Dr. John Watson. Did you read about this?
I was focused on breastfeeding research.
Well, funny thing is, I was reading this article and then I started to do research on what was happening in the article.
Right.
And, the funny thing is in the article, it talks about Dr. James Watson.
Mm-hmm.
So I thought to myself, James Watson?
That's a behaviorist. Yep.
Wait a minute. Isn't mm-hmm. it John Watson? So they made a mistake in the article. John Watson. But Dr. John Watson was like the father of behaviorism.
Yeah.
Right?
Yep.
And he wrote a book called Psychological Care of Infant and Child, believe it or not.
That sounds like a behaviorist title for a book.
He put his very considerable weight behind what you should do with your newborn, with your children, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. And he was a very strict behaviorist, as you know.
Babies are a blank slate.
They are a blank slate. And the most important thing you can do is decide how you want to mold them, right?
Right.
And put behaviorist principles into place so that you can get the behaviors you want out of them.
Shape their behaviors.
That's it.
Through rewards and consequences.
He didn't believe in consciousness.
Yeah.
Okay, so there was no, I remember this.
Scientific parenting.
This is back in the day.
Finest.
I hope I got this right, but back in the day, I remember the behaviorists got to the point where they thought, there's no actual thoughts. There's only like it's your vocal cords that are like at sub audible levels that is actually what constitutes
thought. You're talking to yourself.
Like everything is a behavior, right?
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
And so his whole idea in this parenting book back in the 20s was, I got a quote from him here. Check this out. He warns, to the extent to which you devote time to petting and coddling, just to that extent do you rob the child of the time which he should be devoting to the manipulation of his universe.
Mm.
So that the idea there is, if you give them too much attachment, too much coddling, right, then they're not as likely to be independent and master the world around them.
Right.
They and won't learn. That's something that's right through to books that are out on the shelves to this day. Like the idea that the opposite idea to attachment is that if you give your child too much like warmth and affection and make them too dependent that way,
right,
then they're just going to be dependent on you. They won't be able to go out into the world and actually be successful, independent people.
Mm-hmm.
That's the alternative here, right?
The experts are definitely giving parents some ideas on what they should do. And they're ideas that kind of go against the natural instinct for parents, right?
It seems like they do. Yeah. It does seem like they do. Although that's not a radical idea to think that, well, you know, you're being a little bit too, you're making your child too dependent and you're not letting them let go because you have your own dependency needs. I mean, that's something that's been around for a long time as an idea.
Well, still around, yeah.
For sure. But I guess the idea behind the attachment parenting is that you get that independence by fulfilling their need for security, and you do that by having a strong relationship first.
Right.
That's how they become independent, by you being attached to them.
Well, and I think that early attachment research is pretty clear in that respect, right? Once the infant or the toddler has a secure base, that's when they can begin to explore their world, when they feel confident in that prime relationship with their attachment figure, usually their mother in that early research, but also the fathers too.
So giving that doesn't promote dependence. It actually gives them the security to explore their world.
What I think all the research agrees on is that that's something that helps kids to become resilient over time and to be able to adapt to the problems that come up when they are exploring their world. We know that securely attached kids have all kinds. I mean, there's all kinds of benefits to that, right? And that's what the attachment research says, is that secure bond, which is warm, responsive parenting, and high expectations too. You can have expectations on your kids even with that. That's what allows them to become mature and to develop into well-adjusted adults over time. The attachment parenting approach isn't necessarily, I mean, it started out, it arose from that idea that the secure bond was the most important thing. And, you know, from Dr. Sears and building on what Dr. Sears had to say and his wife had to say in their book, they have some ideas about how that bond is established and maintained, right?
They do. And like I say, they extrapolated their own idea from that basic premise of those early experiments were solid, and they did show that it's a good thing.
Right.
But how far do you take that? Do you take that to the point where you have to chew the food for your child and do what
birds
do?
Feed it from your mouth, yeah.
I mean, you don't have to do that to have a well-adjusted child. If you want to do that, I don't think there's any harm to it.
No, I think the criticism of that stuff came from, is it hygienic or not? And there's a few doctors saying, well, I don't know how hygienic that is, but you're kissing your child anyway, so I don't know.
I think you're doing that, sure.
Well, hopefully. I mean, if you have a good attachment with your little baby, okay. Well, look, let's look at those four main things that you mentioned at the beginning that Dr. Sears talked about, and that most of the recommendations for attachment parenting arise or are focused on these four things. And the number one thing, I think, is the breastfeeding piece.
And the breastfeeding piece, if you look at the American Academy of Pediatrics, their recommendation, I think it's also the World Health Organization recommendation as well, is that women breastfeed, if they can, for the first 6 months.
Exclusively for the first six months. So no other food.
And then starting with six months, then you supplement the breast milk with other foods.
That's right.
And that can go on for 2 years or more is what they're suggesting.
Well, their breastfeeding schedule.
But the first part of that is that exclusive 6 months of breastfeeding. That's the recommendation.
Right. And their schedule that they have on their website, it looks at, well, they talk about breastfeeding for the first 2 years at least, and nobody's saying it couldn't or shouldn't go beyond that.
Right. And I mean, there's no reason to believe it's going to harm your baby. That's for sure. And there are reasons to believe that it could help. It could help your baby's health over the long term, lower blood pressure, cholesterol, lower rates of obesity, that kind of thing. And also
IQ
women's
scores
health,
even.
And even IQ, IQ scores, you're right. Although I feel like we've talked about IQ scores in the past and there was some controversy over that because of the amount... The amount
of small
difference
amount. Yeah.
that they found in IQ was so tiny.
Right.
But then the women's health also, it's a natural birth control, not 100%, but it's pretty good.
Mm-hmm.
They reduce their rates of breast cancer and ovarian cancer, and it helps control obesity as well.
Yeah.
So I mean, there's health reasons for women. There's health reasons for kids.
There's no research that
says
it's
harmful. All the nutrition that you need. And so, and there are other drawbacks if you're using the bottle. You have to make sure they're sterilized. There's risk of infection and that kind of thing.
There's a bit of an issue, though, with the breastfeeding piece. And you can see from the statistics, the World Health Organization has been collecting data from different countries around the world on the prevalence of breastfeeding and how long it goes on for. And in Canada... around 90% of women attempt breastfeeding, but only about 14.5% are still breastfeeding exclusively at that 6-month mark.
Listen, and that's why, you know, they do have clinics, because when you first try to breastfeed, and I'm telling women this, listen to me, okay? When you first start breastfeeding, I know there's clinics that help you to latch, because it's not necessarily that easy for all women to and infants to get that.
Now, the nurses told us, I remember this because, well, our first baby was very small. He was tiny, and so we were very concerned about his feeding, of course, and we both wanted my wife to breastfeed. And I remember distinctly the nurses said, it's going to take 6 weeks for you to learn and for the baby to figure this out. It's going to take 6 weeks, so there's going to need to be some effort there. I don't know if everybody gets that message, because if you look at the media, the message is you need to breastfeed.
Just
you
do
should
it.
Breastfeed,
yeah.
Right? I found a quote, breastfeeding is the medical gold standard for infant feeding and is the moral gold standard for mothering.
Mm-hmm.
Right? So
that's what makes it tough, though. There's pressure.
Yes,
too,
there's
right?
pressure, but everybody says you should do it, but nobody really talks about the hiccups that get that might get in the way or the obstacles.
Right. And it can be painful.
Yes.
And that the other thing is there's different standards around the world, too, in terms of how I know, like here in Canada, I believe now it's you have a year. Is it 2 years now? I know when... For our first child, we had a year.
Mm-hmm.
I believe for our second child, we had a year as well.
Yeah.
That the mom can take away from work,
mm-hmm.
Or either parent can split that.
Yes,
like you
can
have both of them splitting it. But of course, I'm not going to be breastfeeding, so that's neither here nor there. But if the mom doesn't have that option, I don't know.
I think that's a luxury in Canada for sure.
That's right. I think in Europe they're pretty good with that. I think it's less in the States.
In the States, yeah.
And so, you know, if you have to be back to work in 2 weeks, that's a real problem in terms of, I mean, you'd have to be really doing a lot of extra work to be trying to breastfeed. Now, to give Dr. Sears some credit here, he does say that, you know, you could breastfeed after work, and that will give you that bonding time as well after work that can still be helpful. So, but you know, it's really difficult if you're going back to work.
That's right, and I think the attachment parenting groups and I'm sure Dr. Sears as well advocate that workplaces should make themselves as breastfeeding friendly as possible to allow for those things to happen, because it's important for the kids. And like you said, it's important for the moms. There's no evidence that extended breastfeeding, that the kind of thing that we saw on the cover of Time magazine, is going to create long-term harm. Although you can expect that 10 years from now or 15 years from now, somebody's going to trot out that magazine cover and say, where are they now? And they'll go find that kid in high school.
That's right.
And all of his friends will be like, heh.
But yeah, not only that, but you got the situation where we're focused so much on this very tiny context, like are you breastfeeding or aren't you breastfeeding? If you are, it's very good for all these reasons. If you're not, it's not good for these reasons. But there's a larger context here.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
You could be breastfeeding your child and treating them poorly in other ways.
This is true.
So that right? It's not
a formula-fed baby in a very happy, loving, warm household.
Absolutely,
is going to do better than someone who's being abused in a home where they're also being breastfed.
That's right, and that's the other thing. I think it's important to recognize every woman has to understand this for themselves and how what works for them. Because if you're the type of person that is likely to get very, very frustrated. Okay, because you feel this pressure and something you have to do, but it's been painful. It's not been an easy thing for you to do. And you're doing it out of this pressure only. Mm-hmm. Your frustration can boil over and that's not going to be good for the child. So you have to know yourself what you're comfortable with and what you're prepared to do. And know that for yourself and not be so concerned about the judgment of others. Easier said than done, of course.
Of course.
But that's, I think, something that you have to balance for yourself, regardless of these really very focused directives that you're hearing, right?
Yeah. Yeah. And speaking of things that are easier said than done, there's that co-sleeping thing.
Right.
And that is definitely something that's easier said than done, because it's not always easy to sleep with a baby in your bed.
Well, this is interesting, though. Now, American Academy of Pediatrics is saying it's not recommending co-sleeping.
Every study I could find, and I looked everywhere, and in fact, I found one study that cited this statistic. The rates of sudden infant death syndrome have dropped dramatically since 1991 when they started that back-to-sleep program that advocated having babies put on their back to sleep. At that time, 12% of sudden infant death syndrome deaths, I guess, occurred with babies who were sleeping in a bed with their parent. That's now 50%, according to that paper. So in general, the rates of sudden infant death syndrome have dropped, but the proportion of babies who are dying from that mysterious, because it is, people still aren't really sure what the reason is for these deaths from this mysterious illness or problem, the proportion of kids who are co-sleeping and having that problem has increased over time. So the babies who are sleeping on their own and sleeping on their back are less likely, but there's something about sleeping in bed with an adult.
Well, I have to say this. Now, here's one of these things where, yes, it's not recommended and there is that chance of sudden infant death syndrome. Again, mysterious. There's not the kind of study where people are going to be sitting around in random households like awake all night, bleary-eyed, trying to figure out what happened, right? So it is a bit mysterious. But I can tell you that my wife had our sons both in bed with us, and it's not because she read it anywhere, and it's not because, either way, that you shouldn't or should do it. I do remember at the time, though, asking the physician, the pediatrician, and the pediatrician said that as long as, now, this is my pediatrician, like I just said, what we're hearing is it's not recommended generally, right?
Right.
But the pediatrician said, if you have a problem with drugs and alcohol, then yes, you should not have the child co-sleeping with you. Or if you've just been drinking a lot that night, for instance, or doing drugs that night.
Drinking and drug use, obesity of the parent, and smoking were three things that were associated with that higher risk of infant death syndrome.
Right. So something about that impairs your unconscious mind while you're sleeping, because generally speaking, the same reason you don't roll off your own bed.
Right.
Right.
And I think even the attachment parenting people, I think in one of the brochures I read that came from them, said if you're really, really tired and there's a risk that you might not wake up in response to your baby, don't sleep in the same bed with your baby. They do recommend sleeping in the same room if you're not going to sleep in the same bed.
Right. Now, like I said, my wife did it just naturally, because what was happening was we would have the baby in the bassinet in the room, and the baby was crying a lot and getting up frequently to want to feed.
Yeah.
And so all that did was mean that my wife had to, you know, get up. It was dark, turn lights on,
right?
Grab the baby. The baby's crying already. Mm-hmm. And now she's fully awake between the lights and the crying.
Right.
you know what I mean?
Yep.
So that just made her very, very tired mm-hmm. during the daytime and less able to function properly. Mm-hmm. So when she had the baby in bed with us, there wasn't the crying, there wasn't the lights being turned
right.
on.
Right. And these are the benefits that the attachment parents will talk about.
I got to tell you, you know, because some places you read that, you know, I know there's a rebuttal from a father, even in the Time magazine article, saying
right.
A little bit of distance is a good thing, mm-hmm. right? That's mm-hmm. what he's saying. But and part of that is he's saying, well, if they're co-sleeping, then you're going to get kicks in the back and all that kind of thing. But I don't know if it's because we have a bigger bed, okay? But I slept better
yeah.
that way as well, because again, there wasn't as much crying. The lights weren't being turned on.
And well, and the baby's
it worked
not,
really well for us.
The baby's not supposed to be between you either. He's supposed to be sort of on the other side,
well,
beside mom.
I can't recall which side
mm-hmm.
myself at this point.
Wow.
But all I can tell you is it worked.
Well, and so again, we have to emphasize because of what we do that the American Medical Association or American Association of Pediatrics in general, the research is suggesting that co-sleeping is not a great idea.
A danger there, yes.
And even the folks who are recommending it, the Attachment Parenting International groups, they advocate some safety precautions as well. So we can leave it at that, I guess.
And that's right. And I'm something not to recommending
maybe,
it.
No, it's something to maybe talk to your doctor about.
But like I said, it did work for our family.
Right. And I think we also have to remember that these four things that we're talking about that are promoting the bond between the mother, primarily the mother and the child, they aren't necessarily the only way that you can bond with your child.
And right. bonding doesn't stop in the first 3 years.
And bonding doesn't stop, right? I mean, we all know that those are important years. There's no question about that. But if there weren't plasticity in
well,
terms of
the
these things,
thing.
Then
that's
psychologists it. Wouldn't have a job.
Exactly, you know? And you have to think about it that way. I think, like one of the, I mentioned this earlier. I think that you know one of the things Bill Sears kind of extrapolates, I think, a little bit too far on is the idea that if the baby cries for too long a period, that there's brain damage.
That's an issue, I think.
I think that goes a little too far. Now, does that mean that everything he talks about is not valid? No.
No.
You know what I mean? But that's one of the places where I don't think the research is there for him to be able to say that. But he believes so strongly in it. And if you read the article and you read about him a little bit, he is, a genuinely very warm person that even with his, he's a pediatrician and he still takes clients, I think, although mm-hmm. he's retired.
Mm-hmm.
And he is a very warm person even with the young children that come in his office.
Yeah, there's no question about it. I mean, he cares about kids. He cares about his kids. And it's, three of his kids are doctors, I think. So
that's right.
Right?
I think the two
are doctors.
But the thing is that when he's saying that about the brain damage, he's neglecting this idea that there is plasticity.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
That there is an opportunity to bond later with children.
Right.
If you've done something that because
kids really can recover from things.
Yes, right? And it's not strictly about whether your brain is damaged or not. We're talking also about relationships. And what this does for, if your child, we're going to talk about crying now.
Let's talk about crying. Right?
Yep. If your child does some crying, I don't think there's no evidence to say that there's brain damage there.
No.
If
your child is in a situation with chronic stress, if there's chronic stressors, that's where those stress hormones become more of a problem.
And chronic stressors could be based on the fact that you're not available as a parent for whatever reason.
For a long period of time.
For a long period of time.
Not just for a few minutes.
Not just for a few minutes that the baby's crying. Now here's the other thing. If you're having your child cry for a long time, it doesn't mean they're going to have brain damage. But does it teach them something about your relationship with them?
Yep.
That's another issue. It doesn't have to be brain damage. It can be that the child is giving up on searching for that comfort from you.
Mm-hmm.
That's why they stop crying. We've talked about that before.
And this is a problem, I think, that you know, they talk about putting kids on a feeding schedule. They talk about putting, you know, the cry it out, the Ferber method to get kids to stop crying at night and sleep through the night. And they talk about increasing independence. And some of these things are predicated on the idea that infants are manipulating their parents, that they just want their parents around and because they want attention for no particular reason. But the fact is that infants aren't manipulating anybody. And infants need attention. And if they're crying, there's usually a reason why they're crying.
They need it.
They need you there for something, and that's the only way that they can communicate
that.
They
need you, and if you give them what they need, it's not a bad thing. You're not making them dependent.
Right, and I think what happens, part of the criticism of attachment parenting is that often parents extrapolate this idea that infants shouldn't be left to cry up through the toddler years, that your toddler should never cry, that your young child should never cry, and young children might cry because you didn't buy them a transformer at the grocery store.
Right. You know. So here's the thing about what kind of crying's happening there, right?
There's
a difference.
Is
it a cry for security?
Yeah.
You know, that's what you have to understand.
Right.
If it's a cry for security, you need to be there.
You need to respond to it.
You have to.
Responsiveness is very important for attachment.
Yes. If they're crying because of the toy, well, you know, you can be there in terms of their frustration, right?
Uh-huh.
But it's not the same as a security cry.
That's right. And one of the guys we've been talking about again and again and again in the last several weeks since we saw him and we talked to him on the show is Gordon Neufeld, right?
Yep.
And Neufeld is a big believer in the fact that crying and having your feelings of sadness about things that cannot be changed is a very important factor in adapting, in becoming resilient, and becoming that mature, functioning adult, that successful adult that attachment parents want their kids to be.
Letting kids have their tears is, I think, what he says.
Letting kids have their tears. The kids need to have their tears about things that can't be changed. And I think that's where the criticism comes from, is that if you run to rescue your child, your older child, every single time he's crying that he's not getting something that he wants, not because a need isn't being met, but because he's not getting what he wants, that's something that might become an issue.
That's right.
And I don't think that kind of crying is going to cause anybody brain damage.
No.
No. It might cause your parents, the parent brain damage, but.
That's right.
Cause some frustration anyway when the tears are coming up often about things like that. Now, the fourth part that we haven't really talked about yet is that baby wearing thing where you have to have close physical skin to skin when possible contact with your kids and don't use strollers. Strollers are not cool.
Well, strollers and I guess cribs, right, are not cool either.
Well,
unless they're like right up against your bed or something.
They have to be in the same room, or they should be in the same room.
Right.
So,
but cribs, I'm pretty sure I read that like cribs that are like in another room are, and I think this was Dr. Sears' wife was saying that she sees them as little prisons.
Yes. I think that's what she said.
Right.
Well, and I remember my younger guy, when he moved out of our bedroom, I had to sleep on the floor beside his crib.
I had to do that too.
Oh boy.
On a very thin carpet.
Yeah. I had a little mattress that I was able to squeeze underneath his crib. And so I'd be lying on this little mattress and I'd have to have my arm on his back all the time. And we didn't have to worry on his tummy, right? Because he was sleeping on his back.
Yeah.
Or holding his hand. And I couldn't move. If I moved, he knew and he'd wake up and he'd look at me like, you know. And it wasn't because he needed to be fed, but he did need that comfort.
Now, I have to say,
you know what? He still sleeps in bed with us a lot of the time.
Well,
about co-sleeping.
Yeah.
Well, he's eight.
That's right. We had that up until recently, and we figured out a way to have him sleep in his bed, but we need to be there with him so that he can fall asleep.
Mm-hmm.
And that could be, well, that's every night.
Yeah.
But it could be, lately it's been maybe once a night that he wakes up maybe 2-3 o'clock in the morning.
Mm-hmm.
And we go back to his room, we tuck him in and we lay down in bed with him.
Mm-hmm.
He falls asleep very quickly, and then we go back to our bed.
There you go.
But he's fine that way. But I have to tell you about the baby sling.
Yes.
My wife had one.
Right.
Did your wife have one?
We did have one, but she couldn't quite get it.
It was
well, you know,
uncomfortable.
My
I
wife
tried
is
it
so,
myself.
Is so short. It was hard for her to yeah, it wasn't working for her.
Well, yeah, it wasn't working for her or me. Like, I tried it for a while,
oh, yeah,
too.
I wanted to use it. I think I wore it once, maybe, but it didn't work for
like
me either.
It was, like, really uncomfortable. I
like the backpack better. There's, like, a back, more of a backpack
yeah,
one.
Yeah, I've seen
that.
That
seemed to be
it just seemed
okay,
to be but counterproductive to have a backpack. Like, you're not facing them.
Yeah.
I wasn't feeling that. Mm-hmm. I thought maybe the sling would be good, you know, because it frees up your arms too, and you're right, still close to the baby. The baby's comforted and the whole thing, but it felt like you could barely move, and that there was no give. Maybe we had
a
sling,
yeah,
but the baby couldn't move in and out from your chest. It was like trapped. It felt trapped to me. I don't know. So it didn't quite work for us, but I know I saw a lot of moms in the neighborhood walking with them, and it worked for them.
Yeah. Well, I mean, obviously it works for some people. Yeah. I mean, it's certainly being advocated. I couldn't find any research on baby wearing to say whether it has any kind of an impact or not. Certainly touch does have an impact on babies, and sensitive touch and things like that, you know, caressing and hugging and kissing and things like that are beneficial. I've found some studies to show that, no doubt. But it wasn't so much the frequency as the kind of touch that was important, mm-hmm, as the fact that you were being responsive, and that it was those caring kind of caresses and things like that were more important than how often you were touching the baby, which kind of says, well, maybe the slings would be okay, but maybe they're not absolutely necessary.
I mean,
I don't know.
If Dr. Watson had a sling on, probably wouldn't be the same effect, for instance.
Well, maybe if Dr. Watson
he might have been doing an experiment while the sling was on.
Maybe if when he was a baby he had been in a sling, he wouldn't have come up with all of those great ideas that he had.
Perhaps
he would think totally differently. That's possible. So I mean, I don't think there's anything bad about wearing a baby in a sling if you can do it comfortably, and
no,
if it's comfortable for your baby, I think that's a great thing.
That's it. Again, I mean, some people have back issues too. So
yeah,
so to me,
you shouldn't feel guilty about if you don't.
Guilty.
I don't
no,
think,
but it can't hurt the baby, and if it's comfortable for you, and you don't, I guess again, if you don't have back issues,
yeah,
or whatever the case may be, then sure, why not do it? There's no reason not to,
and I don't think
you have
there's
some personal difficulty there.
And I don't think your child is going to get brain damage, or that your relationship is going to be irreparably harmed by putting them in a stroller.
No,
you probably are going to be okay. You're probably as long as those other things are happening. Attachment parenting needs to happen in a context.
Yes,
right, and in the context of a warm, responsive relationship,
and through your life with this individual, whether that be your baby or whether it be your partner that you're engaged to, or married to, or living with.
Yes, indeedy.
I think that's about it. What do you think?
It sounds like it's bringing us to
top three things.
Let's do it.
And the number one thing to remember is that bonding with your baby is important. And there are many ways to bond that go well beyond the baby and toddler years. If your focus is the relationship, you'll find it easier to get the behavior you want to see in your kids, and it'll be good for everyone.
No question about it. The number two thing is that attachment parenting has lots of good ideas going for it. No question about it. There is nothing wrong with extended breastfeeding. In fact, it's probably beneficial. Most of the research says so. Sensitive touch is very important, so baby wearing might be a great idea too, as long as it's comfortable for you and your baby. Like Giuseppe said, there are lots of ways to bond with your child, not only the ones recommended by attachment parents, but many of their ideas are good ones.
And the third thing to remember is that having your baby cry, letting your baby cry, does not cause brain damage. There's no research to support that. But on the other hand, if you're not being responsive to your baby's cries, when their security cries, when it comes from a sense of anxiety and insecurity, that may affect your relationship, and they may learn not to rely on you. And that's it for us. You can visit us at familyanatomy.com or email us at info@familyanatomy.com.
You can find us on Facebook. You can find us on Twitter. And as usual, we'll leave you with a bit of a tune by Brother Love. And he's over at brotherloverocks.com.
Thanks for listening.
See you in 2 weeks. So get up.
It's a family thing. Hey! You know what to do.
FamilyAnatomy.com.